Let me talk about some work that we've been doing at Boston College and a few other places. Have you seen your pointer?
Are you looking for a pointer?
Pointer, yeah. Okay. And it's some work that we started actually a while ago, and it's been in collaboration mostly with Kristen Bulgaro and Jan Engelbrecht. More recently, a student of mine just finished, Wenjin Mao and Zigan Wang, on some aspects of this. I'm not going to talk about that in detail, but I'll mention a little bit also of some work going on with Noam Karchuk. Now, the thing I want to first talk about is just the word weak. It kind of makes you think that this is an uninteresting field because the interactions might be weak in that material. Before I give you an outline, let me just show you some classic examples of what are called weak ferromagnets. And if you know anything about energy scales for these systems, you'll realize right away these are not weak in the sense of weak interactions. And in fact, these are extremely strongly interacting systems. If you look at characteristic fermion energies on materials like MnSi, zirconium, zinc 2, and more recently uranium and germanium 2, they come in the ballpark of a few hundred degrees, which is not a sort of typical heavy fermion type fermion energies. They undergo magnetic transitions which have typically scales of the order of 10 to 50 degrees for the, and this is a ferromagnetic transition temperature. So it's also quite a small scale in the problem. So this is what I'm going to talk about is not going to be anything to do with any high temperature anything. So it's low Fermi temperatures, low Curie temperatures, and even lower still superconducting transition temperatures. But there are actually some lessons to be learned from these materials, and hopefully I can tell you a little bit about that, and there are some surprises as well. Hopefully I'm not the only one that was surprised, at least when I went and gave this talk at Cambridge. Dima Kalminsky told me that the Russians did all of it already. Fortunately, he pointed me to that work, and it wasn't the same thing, so he hasn't found yet the reference, but he could have sworn they did it already. They started it, and I'll tell you a little bit about that. So anyway, this is kind of the typical phase diagram for these ferromagnets, and there's some interesting scales in this problem. In addition to the Curie temperature, there is a crossover scale where there's a real phenomena that happens, as we see experimentally in high TC. This also happens both experimentally and theoretically, and you can actually follow it. It's one of those few things where you can actually do the theory. At low temperature, you can show, and this was microscopically done in the 70s by a couple of Russians, Yelchinsky and Kondratenko, but the fermi-liquid phase was first described back in the 50s by Abrikosov and Yelchinsky. So this is really a Russian product. They started a lot of this a long time ago. But down here you have a well-defined fermi-liquid phase, and as you go up in temperature, you find you actually cross over into a non-fermi-liquid-like phase. It's I would say, just a crossover regime from fermi-liquid to non-fermi-liquid. This scale looks, it's not drawn to scale. I mean, this is a temperature, if you just throw in some numbers, of the order of 1 degree or so for a system like MnSi or zirconium zinc 2. It's somewhat larger, of the order of 10 degrees for uranium germanium 2, and that's going to be an important number later on for the scale of things.
Kevin, just so I understand, this whole thing below the black solid line is an itinerant ferromagnet.
It's an itinerant ferromagnet.
Its character changes as you cross the gap.
Yeah, and in fact, in this region here, it has, for example, in the specific heat, you get T log T specific heat, just as you would expect for... It's T log T. It's like a marginal fermi-liquid. And down here it goes into typical linear T temperature patterns. And so in that sense it's a crossover. And what happens basically is the temperature becomes comparable to the magnon gap, and that is the paramagnon gap. And those things become very soft up here, and then you get this kind of non-fermi-liquid like behavior. So the thing is... Typically, Fermi energy of the system is in the hundreds of degrees.
These effective mass really large.
It could be very high. Also, they can also be a little bit dilute. But typically, it's very large effective masses.
What's the temperature range on which you extract the log T log T?
If this is about
10 Kelvin.
Yeah, 10. to 30. I mean, in fact, these things are up to about 30, 40 degrees, and this is about a 1 degree. So the Fermi liquid really is far below the T star. And so, you know, this is either less than or much less than the T star. And then the non-Fermi liquid starts to cross over into that. And so you would see it below here, but above here. And the interesting thing about that scale, if you look at it, it's of the order of the Curie temperature squared over the Fermi energy. It's like condensation energy in a superconductor. So it's a natural energy scale for that system. And these are all very small. There is also interesting point here, as a function of pressure, these things undergo transition from ferromagnetic metal to paramagnetic metal. And there's a nice quantum critical point there. So there's a lot of quantum critical physics, and I'm not going to go into the details of that either. But the experimentally, there's a lot of interesting features which are non-Fermi liquid-like, and they're seen all over the place.
What's that?
Like superconductivity.
Well, superconductivity we'll get into as well. And that's one of the surprises. And let me just... Okay, so that's just to set the scale, but I want to just give a brief outline just to, and brief summary of basically what we know about ferromagnetic metals, or at least the textbook level of it that was known, and why we have to go beyond that, in particular about the phenomenology of ferromagnetic metals. And I'll introduce you to the ferromagnetic Fermi liquid theory, first proposed by Jaloschinsky, Avrikosov and Jaloschinsky back in the 50s, and then go from there to derive sort of like the first new surprise for this was the spin hydrodynamics. The classical spin hydrodynamics was known and understood for quite some time, but what we found, you have to do the same thing you do in the ordinary Fermi liquid. You have to look for what's called zero sound-like regimes, that is, collisionless regimes, and we call it quantum spin hydrodynamics to distinguish it from classical, and I'll show you how that arises strictly from the assumption of the Fermi liquid theory. And you know, so there is a new mode, and I can say that with certainty. Unfortunately, at least the traditional probe is going to be very difficult to see it, and we're trying to cook up new ways of seeing that. The other big surprise for us, actually the first surprise was that PRL actually accepted it a while ago. That was surprise number one. Surprise number two is that it comes from the same kinds of arguments we've used in the paramagnetic phase, why we believe, for example, in a system like helium or some of the other strongly enhanced metals, why it should be P-wave. So the same arguments, see many body arguments, on the ferromagnetic side changes the sign on you, and you'll see that in a moment. And that was the interesting surprise. And the S-wave interaction seems to be the dominant one. And then I'll go on and talk about an experiment that was done. Just to get you thinking about ferromagnets, just classical, simple picture, and just to, you know, we've talked about these Heisenberg models. Just for those of you who grew up in ITC, there are materials where J has another sign to it. and this model gives you a sense of ferromagnetic order in classical local moment ferromagnets. This is kind of the traditional picture. Long range order develops at some temperature. This is 3D, even though I've only drawn a 2D picture. But for a 3D, long range order sets in at some temperature, and the positive sign gives rise to ferromagnetic long-range order in this system. So we have some spontaneously generated moment. And the, again, classical picture is that moment has some simple temperature dependence, T, which goes like so. It decreases at some transition temperature to zero, and you have your transition. Now, with this long-range order, there is a broken symmetry, and it's associated with all the moments are aligned in some direction, of course, which direction can be anywhere, so the fact that the spins can precess at any direction or point in any direction relative to, let's say, this is the z-axis, is what gives rise to the so-called Goldstone mode.
So this is an isotropic system?
Yeah.
And the spins are spin...
Spin one-half isotropic, or it could even large s. It doesn't... I just want to... I'm not even going to use this. I'm not even going to write them another Hamiltonian for anything I'm going to talk about. So it's just to remember what the spin wave is. You know, the direction could be anywhere in space, and the cost and energy is minimal when there's no external field.
The other thing is the magnetization's conserved quantity, even in the ferromagnetic phase, so instead of the usual linear Goldstone mode, you get a quadratic dispersion for the Goldstone mode. That's why you get T to the 3 halves in the specific heat coming from this mode. Now, if I turn on an external field, and I ask what is the precession rate, the precession rate for the ferromagnet, even though I've got this long-range magnetic order, is just that of the free spins. In this case here, spin 1/2, it's just the Lamar frequency associated with that external field. So even with all this long-range order and these interactions, because the spin is a conserved quantity, it precesses around the external field as if it was free spins. That's the only message I want you to go away with. And the fact that spin waves in these ferromagnets get T to the 3 halves in specific heat. Now, if I move over to metals, the order parameter in that case is given, depends on your favorite sign, either n up minus n down, or majority minus minority spins. The order parameter is just the difference between spins, let's say, up species and down species. And that can be simply understood in terms of a simple Fermi surface volume. We have, let's say, a larger volume to spin up and spin down. It's an internally generated, you know, spontaneously generated internal magnetic field that produces that net magnetization, but there's our order parameter. And you can, again, go through the same kind of argument. We're in momentum space now. I just suddenly transferred over into momentum space, but the same kind of argument. I have this moment pointing somewhere in space, but anywhere in momentum space is the same energy. Therefore, I'm going to have magnons associated with that. But there's additional excitations. We'll come back to the magnon in a moment. And that is the fact that there's still electrons still floating around. And this is pretty old story. Goes back to Slater and Stoner in the 30s. The electronic spectrum due to this spontaneously generated internal field is shifted, but it's not shifted at the Fermi surface. It's not a gap in the Fermi surface, but in fact this shift, you can say, is at the bottom of the bands. There is still a Fermi level, still a Fermi surface, in fact two Fermi surfaces of different volumes, and that's the spectrum that's generated by the internally generated field. So essentially J times M is the internal field that's spontaneously generated. The so-called Stoner gap, which is basically on this picture the difference in the bottoms and the bands, is J times M. And this number will come back a little bit later on in the picture. Now, because we have a Fermi gas still with the simple spectrum, the E sub P is just the spectrum given to you from the band theory. It could be quadratic, but it could be a more complicated spectrum. And most of the work has been done on the ferromagnets, has been done on, you know, improving band theory for it. There's been a lot of work on that. The many-body theory, though, has been basically Slater-Stoner. You know, you just put in the Slater-Stoner term, and then you put in the fancier bands, and you get your ferromagnetic ground state. Right, so now I still have fermions present. I have a linear T in specific heat, so at low temperature, even though I have these magnons, which I said I have because I've got this long-range order, etc., which could be T to the 3 halves there as well, the dominant low-temperature specific heat is in the fermion still. If I go to low enough temperature, I can ignore the magnons.
So the magnons of this band ferromagnet, right, their quantum mechanics is completely different from the localized magnets. Is that correct?
That actually has a quadratic dispersion.
So for example, for the localized magnet, when you put on the magnetic field, you do not increase the overall sign, overall magnitude of spin. Here, if I put on the magnetic field, I will increase. This is not a maximum magnetization state.
No, this isn't right. This is right, not fully spin polarized.
Right. And so, whereas previously
But you could have that. If you have a big enough internal power, you could generate it. Right, so in principle, and it's still, you'll still have one Fermi surface still present, so you still have Fermi.
The problem, well, maybe we'll get to that later, but the problem that I have is that whereas previously you could define, whereas previously you had an omega proportional to Q squared,
right,
you know, dispersion, the magnum was a long-lived,
You'll see it turns out, it is, because the magnon, remember, is a transverse spin wave excitation, so it has spin one. And if I look at, let's say this is the classic picture you find in the textbook, the particle hole excitations, which are the things now that the magnon can couple to, are gapped. The single particle excitations aren't, but you have to create a particle hole excitation with spin one in order to
decay the magnon. So here's your magnon down here, going to Q is Q, like Q squared, and you have this band of particle hole excitations, which are spin one excitations, which have this infamous Stoner gap in. So the magnon propagates because it has nothing to decay into, and this is the standard picture for ferromagnetic metals, single band, multi-band, it gets complicated and messy. And the question, actually on the next transparency, a couple of questions, is that kind of picture all we need? And one controversial, probably, statement, first of all, is this all we need? Well, to begin with, it's not a proper microscopic theory. And let me just go back to the figure for those who weren't here before. In particular, if I'm sitting around the neighborhood of this quantum critical point, I'm going through a point where I'm going from ferromagnetic to paramagnetic, and at that particular point, the effect of coupling, and this J is, in the Stoner theory, the J is just the exchange interaction you generate from this Hartree-Fock theory. This is a point where this parameter has to be of order 1 in order to go through that transition point. And if it's of order 1, clearly Slater-Stoner, which is just Hartree-Fock, if you do magnons, it's Hartree-Fock plus RPA. And RPA is perturbation theory. It's clearly not meaningful to be doing perturbation theory in the neighborhood of 2J over EF equal to 1. Surprisingly, though, this seems to work very well for some things. These orders of magnitude aren't so bad. So why is that? So, well, it might be that this is a reasonable phenomenology. In fact, it turns out to be fairly reasonable as long as you don't think that you know how to calculate the parameter J from first principles.
R2C.
What's that?
R2C.
Yeah, well, actually, you know, the interesting thing is that if you do the band theory plus the Stoner, you can get TC's within factor of 3 and the magnetic moment, right?
You can get it better than that unless it's for the spin calculation.
What's that?
You can get it better than that unless it's for the spin calculation. You can get TC up to 10 kelvins for many kelvins, which I find very similar.
But not in these, not for these weak ferro magnets.
Not in these weak ferro.
Yeah, weak ferro magnets, you're way beyond. In something like iron, cobalt, nickel, they haven't done so badly there. But the most interesting point, though, which is this quantum critical point, is it's fundamentally, it can't be a correct theory. And
I'm
going fast.
You're varying the pressure. What is it microscopically? And the magnetization is going to zero.
Yeah, magnetization, magnetic moment.
What's happening to the microscopic interactions that's causing that to go from ferromagnetic to paramagnetic?
Let's say you do it under pressure, you mean?
Yeah, what is the pressure doing?
Well, don't ask me.
Why do you say that when M goes to zero, 2J over E?
Well, we'll come back to what those parameters. I'll give it to you in terms of the phenomenological parameters that govern M going to zero. But what the underlying Hamiltonian's doing?
I guess, I just don't see the connection between, since you've given me no idea why M goes to zero.
Yeah, I'll do that in a minute.
Why this tells me that 2J over E is of order 1 at that point.
Yeah, and I'll show you.
Okay.
Briefly. Yeah, it's basically it's the Stoner criteria. It's 2J over EF.
Do you have ferromagnetic?
Ferromagnetic to paramagnetic transition. And I'll come back to it in a little bit just to show it to you. But that's essentially what the give or take a factor of 2 depends on how you define your J, but that number of order 1 is is where you hit the ferromagnetic transition. And so it's the there's no perturbation theory that you can do and expect to get reasonable results. All right, but as I said, it might be a good phenomenology, and if it was a good phenomenology, then I can end the talk here and not go any further. But in fact, what I'm going to show is that it's not a complete phenomenology that is RPA plus Stoner, and what we'll do is go back to the ferromagnetic Fermi-liquid theory that was developed by Abrikosov and Jaloschinsky and show, in fact, that the dynamics is much richer. Now, I'm going to say this goes way back, and it's interesting because this paper was written in 1956, and they basically did nothing after that. In the paramagnetic phase, a lot was done
and the dynamics and all, but very little was done in terms of carrying this out. And I guess it's, they figured they did it all by just writing it down, and then they left it for people like me to do something with it later on. But the idea here is basically in the same category as the Fermi liquid description for, let's say, helium, where you imagine you turn on interactions from the system. Here you start off with a system that's sort of sitting in a magnetic field, so you have a spin split bands. You turn on the interactions, and you can eventually shut off that field, and you've got an internal field now, which was the thing that produced the magnetization. But the main message in the Landau argument is so-called one-to-one correspondence. You just argue that as you turn on these interactions, for every non-interacting particle, there's one and only one interacting one. We call it a quasi-particle. So for the non-interacting system, for every single particle energy level in the non-interacting system, you have one and only one in the interacting system. There's some collective modes that show up, just like zero sound and things like that. But we know it doesn't change things at the low temperature end, because as long as I do that one-to-one correspondence, the entropy that I calculate is the same as the entropy qualitatively as the entropy for the non-interacting system. I get a linear specific heat, and the order parameter, well, we've already defined, the order parameter is just the difference of the up and down spin excitations. It's just that the field that generated that difference is now an internally generated field due to some spontaneous magnetization.
So this one point correspondence, you don't ask about those two modes.
Right. Well, the thing is, it's just, we'll see that the magnon actually comes out of the dynamics of the excitations in this, just like the zero sound mode and all that comes out of the dynamics of the quasi-particles. It's just like doing sonar, then you do RPA on top of it. It's a little more complicated because the interaction parameters are not simply related to any Hamiltonian. I don't know how to calculate those parameters from a starting Hamiltonian. I mean, you can do models and all, but there is no simple calculation that you can do. But as long as this one-to-one correspondence survives, then the linear specific heat will follow directly from it. Then the magnons will come out later, and we'll see where they come from. Yeah.
I don't know the paper, but just to put it in perspective, this is analogous to what Leggett later did for superconductors, where he decided to fix a BCS theory by putting in
the Yeah, well, in fact, it's, yeah, that's a, there's an analogy to that, and in fact, some of the things that we're going to do later, we actually haven't gotten to doing those additional things where you can put in all those Fermi liquid parameters for like temperature-dependent properties. They're going to renormalize some of the properties of the magnet. We haven't done all of that, but there are, prescriptions for how to do it.
But so you're saying they're kind of quasi-particles.
Yeah, because you still have you have kind of a quasi-particle description. The excitations have changed, but you have a phenomenological description that you can use and put in all the Fermi liquid corrections, and that's what we're going to do here as well. But there's also another analogy between Leggett and Rice and some of the spin dynamics that was done by them for a paramagnetic system. Anyway, so we have still the linear specific heat. We still have the order parameter. But the interactions do change things, and just the traditional examples of it, and we'll come back to scattering amplitudes later on. But just, you have transport, you have response, you have collective modes. In the paramagnetic systems, the famous ones are zero sound and spin zero sound and all those other neat modes. In 3D you have the phase space restriction on scattering, get T squared temperature dependence because of phase space restrictions on the scattering. And typical relaxation times, I just want you to remember that, is that as T goes to zero, the relaxation times become infinite. And that's going to be the crossover we're going to see later on from classical to this quantum spin hydrodynamic regime. Now, let me just remind you what the interactions look like. I'm going to talk about small moments, mostly because it's the only place where I could actually analytically work out the dispersion. It works as well for finite moment, in much larger moments, but I've only been able to do that for Q equals zero, that is for the modes. And, yeah, so let me come down. So the typical scheme is that the interactions on the Fermi surface are the only things that are relevant for most of the low frequency, low temperature properties. And so you can expand that interaction in terms of some parameters. Those are the so-called Landau parameters. When the moment is small, it allows you to still pretend like there are two simple invariants, which is just the density and the sigma dot sigma prime. There are corrections to this, which are of order m and m squared, depending on whether you look at parallel or anti-parallel interactions.
But for what I'm going to do, we can ignore those effects in leading water.
Where they come into play is beyond, you know, if I look at the energy density, one of these Landau parameters plays a very special role, the L equal to zero one, because that determines the location of this magnetic instability. This F naught A is like the effect of J in the magnetic coupling, because it comes in through the exchange part of the interaction. And you can see precisely what's happened here. F naught A, first of all, has to be greater than minus one, excuse me, less than minus one, in order for this thing to have a negative curvature to it, so it has to go down. And that's the signature of the ferromagnetic paramagnetic transition. It's basically F naught A going to minus one. That's the parameter, which is the effective J over the Fermi energy scale, that is of order one. Now, since the moment's small, you can imagine doing some Ginzburg-Landau-like expansion. This parameter here is determined by band structure effects and interaction effects. Typically, it's done just with the band structure, that is density of states, derivatives, and second derivatives, and third derivatives of density of states. And that's what determines whether there is, in fact, a minimum, which is located somewhere over here. So the F naught A plays a special role, and it leads to this instability. Yes?
So, so B is basically determined by non-universal, non-fixed point quantity. So B, for example, could be negative, and you can
start
a phase transition.
Yeah, so in this case here, I'm saying I have a ferromagnet, so it has to be positive.
No. It's not just that. You know, if B was negative, then we have to be a high order.
You could still get
a first order phase transition.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, just doing this interpretive line.
You could expand first order phase transition.
Yeah,
so I'm just dealing here with this. But it's the main feature that I want to point out is that this is less than minus one. So one plus F naught A is negative.
Okay.
That's the key thing to remember.
So experimental transitions, second order and B plus order.
I'll show you. It's mostly second order, but then there's some weak first order stuff that happens, and then I'm in trouble. So that's the thermodynamics, and just like the traditional Fermi-liquid approach, you can introduce the dynamics for the excitations through a kinetic equation. And this was, in some sense, that was the second half of Landau's brilliance in terms of introducing quasi-particles and kinetic and their excitations, is he introduced a kinetic equation, which is basically a quasi-classical equation, in the sense that you can treat the position and time as kind of classical variables, or position and momentum as classical variables, because we're always going to be looking at long wavelength or low frequency excitations, and in that regime then the momentum distribution function is more or less a classical one, and you can generate the equations of motion using Poisson brackets rather than commutators. Of course, when you do spin dynamics, you have to worry about the precession terms, but that's an add-on, and you can do that more carefully, and it's been done properly. So we have a distribution function and a kinetic equation, which is just derived straightforward, nothing magical about it. The magic is that it actually works, and works quite well. And so from that, I can write down the general sort of spin hydrodynamics for this, because I can calculate from the kinetic equation the momentum distribution function, and from that I can calculate the magnetization density and the spin current density as well. And the kinetic equation allows me to do that because I have the distribution function. This is just the quasi-particle velocity and the spin signal. If you do it, you're not surprised that you get the continuity equation. If I had no external field on, it's just a traditional continuity equation. Magnetization is conserved. That's what you would get. There's an additional equation for the spin current, and you can derive it, and after, again, keeping the magnetic field present for the time being, you get this equation. And I'll just go into some detail about some of the features in it. The important extra term in there that you won't see in the classical hydrodynamics is dJdt. If I throw this away, go back to Holmberg and Halpin's paper in 67, after you get over the shock of the notation and all that, you find, in fact, that the equations they write down for spin hydrodynamics, and that's whether it's local moment or if it's itinerant, you get these equations with this thing set to zero, and this parameter takes on a very particular value, and we'll
see what that is in a moment. But why is it, in this classical regime, you can throw away DJDT?
This is what we call the classical spin hydrodynamic regime. If you remember, there was a J over tau sub D in that kinetic equation there.
This term here, and that's there because the spin current is not a conserved quantity. It's diffusive and all this other stuff at the high temperatures. And that term dominates at high temperature, because the tau sub D is very short, so J over tau sub D becomes the dominant term. And if you look at it, then you get a sort of classical behavior that the spin current is diffusive. It decays away in a few seconds, in a few cycles, and so it's not an important quantity to keep in this classical regime. But if you go into the quantum spin hydrodynamic regime, the lifetimes become infinite. Particles will travel through there without any diffusive scattering. And when it becomes infinitely long, the spin hydrodynamics becomes important. In fact, the J over tau sub D goes to zero. You throw that one out. And what's left then is the rest of this equation, and there's no reason to throw out DJDT. As soon as you keep in DJDT, you can see, actually, if I threw it away and I solve for the modes, this is the dynamics that gives me the Q squared dispersion for the magma. I keep it now, I still get the one mode with Q squared for dispersion, but this is going to give me another root, another solution. And that other solution turns out to be a mode which is a collective oscillation of the spin current. Now, let me just go through the new physics of what's there and why is it different. First of all, if I look at the uniform case, as we said before, magnetization in this case, just like it does with the local moment case, still precesses around the magnetic field at the Lomar frequency. If I have no interactions, then this current is also precessing at Lomar frequency. But now let me go to the sort of Slater-Stoner kind of RPA approach. That I just keep the effect of J in the theory. If I just keep that effect of J, again you find in the external field that the magnetization will still precess at the Lomar frequency, which it should do because I haven't violated the conservation of spin. But this other mode now precesses not only around this one, which we can actually set to zero now, just to get a sense that there's a precession rate where it's precessing around this, at this frequency, which is essentially, if I plug in 2F mod A or this J, whatever it was, J over 2, this becomes this the Stoner gap. So you have this magnetic current precessing at precisely the same rate as the particle hole excitations that can damp it. So it becomes a damp mode. It's over-damp mode. So you never see it. Well, fortunately, there are Fermi-liquid effects present, and this is the equivalent in the paramagnetic phase of what's sometimes referred to as Leggett-Rice effect. Sillin was the first to do this in the paramagnetic case. And it turns out the same effects are here in the ferromagnetic case. And that is that this effective field is in fact shifted from the Stoner gap when you include higher order Landau parameters. Now these higher order Landau parameters are in principle there, as long as I'm away from the quantum critical point. In fact, in practice they should be there. And this mode separates off from the Stoner continuum, and depending on the sign of that F1, it's propagated. It's got another avenue for propagation, except it has a gap in it. And that gap is related to this shifted Stoner gap. The Stoner gap doesn't change, but this one does, and this one's because this is a current mode, so the spins are precessing and moving at the same time, and they have to interact with the other fields. It's a kind of a backflow effect that one has for the magnetic excitations.
This is something that we absolutely insulate in
Actually, I want to come back to that at the end, because it's a good question. If I was in a fully spin-polarized metal, this mode would go away, because it is directly connected to the fact that the spin current is not a conserved quantity. Once it's fully spin polarized, then the spin current and current are the same, and here it's conserved in this picture. And so for a fully saturated moment, this mode is not there. Okay, so yeah, this mode has a quadratic dispersion, and we can actually count it, all that stuff. And you can see it propagates, it's well defined. Okay, before I talk about the other surprise, what's disappointing about it is it doesn't have a lot of spectral weight to be seen, say easily in neutron scattering. And because the magnetic moment, the magnetization density can couple to the spin current density, it will show up in neutron scattering. But the dominant scatterer is still the magnon, and this would be then this new one, the spin current mode, and here's the stoner excitations. Now typically this is not there, and you have that in stoner excitations. And if I look at the orders of magnitude, this was just a crude calculation with a Q over K 0.1 weak scattering, and you can see the magnon is enormous, there's a 400 there compared to this. So if you went and did neutron scattering, you'd have a hard time seeing it. A little bit of scattering makes this thing smear out more, whereas this one is unaffected by it, or just weakly affected by it. So everything goes against you. So seeing it directly is, not, at least from neutron scattering, is not that easy. One neutron scatterer said if he had the life on the universe, he could probably find this, but his funding wouldn't last that long. But the one indirect evidence it might be for it is that in order for this thing to gain any kind of spectral weight, it had to, remember, it came out of the stoner continuum. It had to steal its spectral weight from the stoner continuum. In fact, in small q limits, you can show that, in fact, it's stronger. It goes like q squared compared to the stoner excitations. And if you look at some of the neutron scattering papers, they always tell you they know the stoner continuum is there, but they can't see it. So maybe that's indirect evidence that this weight went into this mode and they weren't looking for it. But that's part of that story. Now, so that was the first surprise, that there's new modes there that are unexpected. We're looking for alternative ways to see it. Hopefully we'll have some ideas.
You made the statement that the neutron scattering, they don't see stoner continuum.
Yeah, they actually have difficulty, but this could be an experimental difficulty because it's up there pretty high energies in some of the materials. But in these materials like MNSI, it shouldn't be up that high.
Right.
And apparently there's still difficulty in seeing the continuum. They usually know where the continuum is when the magnon actually starts to decay. That's sort of the standard argument for it, but to date they really have some difficulties in seeing it. And so we're arguing maybe, you know, it just all went into that mode, and now you've got to go look more carefully for that mode. All right, now, to get to the superconducting surprise, I want to just...
Sir, yeah. What is the effect of external magnetic field on this problem? We know of Japp's magnet.
Yeah, so, yeah, and so it'll, what it'll do is, you know, that it has a gap in it already. It'll shift that gap over. All right, so depending on whether this is above or below...
I see. So the external magnetic field brings down the stoner, the particle hole.
It'll shift. See, it'll shift that as well. The question, though, is whether it shifts this one. It's in leading order. Looks like they might just move down together. In the small fields, I don't know what happens in larger fields, because I think some of this stuff is non-linear. All right. Now, let me just switch for a moment to go back to the same story we had before, but I want to shift from Fermi liquid parameters to scattering amplitudes. And just to say that there's still, in this approach, you can write down from the kinetic equation that these scattering amplitudes, symmetric or antisymmetric, are still related to the Fermi liquid parameters. So there's no change in terms of the structure of the equations, that the kinetic equation, I can derive this directly from that. So there's an exact connection between these parameters that determine the instability. When F naught A goes to minus 1, for example, there's this A naught A scattering amplitude. So the amplitude diverges as you approach the instability. And so you can rewrite this expression in terms of the scattering amplitude, because F naught A is close to minus 1, it's roughly the same parameter as F, 1 plus F naught A, which determines then where the moment vanishes. So you can go from scattering amplitudes, or from liquid parameters to scattering amplitudes, and the scattering amplitudes have a special feature that, you know, they should be anti-symmetric under exchange because I have fermions, so I can either do it with the amplitude or do it with the wave function. Now, yeah. Now there's something special about ferromagnetic Fermi liquids as the magnetic moment gets small. That is, as I approach this quantum critical region, I think I had scribbled it earlier on. And I've lost it. In this region down here, and how big this box is anybody's guess, but in this region where the TC over EF is small, if you come in here, the self-energy of the Fermi liquid becomes local. What does that mean? It depends only on the frequency. And that's a statement I can make with certainty to leading order in T Curie over EF. So as long as T Curie over EF is small, that statement becomes exact. In fact, if it goes to zero. Now, just to, I wish I could say it with infinite certainty, but of course if I'm exactly at the quantum critical point, every temperature scale is zero. So TC over EF is small, can be much less than one, but EF is actually going to zero as you approach the quantum critical point, and so does TC. It's a microscopic calculation you can do, and it's again, it was done by Zhalkinsky and Konstantenko in some detail, and we can show, in fact, that it vanishes. The TC, of course, vanishes because that's what's happening as you apply pressure. But the Fermi energy is also vanishing. It's because the effective mass is diverging. It's coming from the spin fluctuations. In fact, the paramagnon is getting softer, and you can show it's got the usual log of m behavior.
The Fermi energy vanishes.
Yeah, the Fermi, because Fermi energy in this language here is, in fact, the quasi-particle Fermi energy.
And the chemical potential stays the same.
Yeah. Fermi energy is defined as d Fermi squared over 2m. Remember, this is p squared over 2m star. M star is one of the Fermi liquid parameters, and you can calculate it from the self-energy. And as I said, the self-energy becomes local, and if you calculate the Z, like so Z goes to zero, the mass diverges. That's
what is the material then on the other side of PC?
Yeah, on this side here, actually it's interesting on the, if you take, I think it's M and SI, this is, the critical pressure is around 10, 15 kilobar. They've gone way out here somewhere, and they still see behavior which is non-Fermi liquid-like, down to the very lowest temperatures. It actually has, you know, funny power laws for the resistivity. It doesn't settle into a nice paramagnetic Fermi liquid phase on this side. Whereas on this side, it settles in very quickly into the ferromagnetic Fermi liquid phase. You see T squared resistivities and all at low temperature on this side. So it's an interesting feature. It's very unsymmetrical as far as pressure is concerned. That the classical kind of Fermi liquid behavior over here, but it has non-Fermi liquid-like exponents in, especially resistivity, I think it's... No, it's still metallic.
Power.
Yeah, it's metallic, it's just that the parallel is not, it's less than T squared, it's less than 2.
So when M star divergence, is this very sensitive to error? Just in terms of things getting
localized? Well, this critical point doesn't change very much from sample to sample. And that, so this quantum critical point is pretty robust. So I don't know what you mean.
Well, I'm just wondering, I'm trying to think of what this working.
Well, right at the quantum critical point, with all the energy scales set to zero, I don't know what they're doing. Right. But I can approach it, and as long as I'm below this T star, I have a nice, well-defined Fermi liquid. I've got a Z, which might be very, very small, a mass, which might be very, very large, but I've got a Fermi liquid regime over here somewhere, inside this box. This side is strange. It's strange compared to this side. And as I say, on this side,
it's basically because you have these, the paramagnon actually has a gap in it, and it's no problem on this side, it seems to do weird things, and I don't know what it is it's doing over there. But experimentally, it's not not very well behaved thermoliquid. Now, so remember that this statement I'm going to make is good to order TC over EF. Now, TC over EF is not, especially in the range that we're going to talk about, it's not exactly zero. So I'm willing to give the P wave types an out. But let me take what happens if I exactly say TC over TF is zero. At that point, as I say, the self-energy is strictly local. The scattering can only be an S wave. This is something that we showed a few years ago. If I have a local self-energy, there's only S wave scattering, and that's the full self-consistency you have to impose once you have a local self-energy. And the amusing thing that happens on the ferromagnetic side, because of the sign change of F naught, 1 plus F naught A is now negative, is that the singlet amplitude is attractive. If you go on the paramagnetic side, it's repulsive. And it suppresses S waves and so on. And that's why we always like the triplet on the paramagnetic side. And I've been on that bandwagon for longer than I want to remember. But suddenly you go on this one, you go on the other side, use the same arguments, and you impose the self-consistency of the local Fermi-liquid, this is attractive. So I have a scattering amplitude which is attractive, I have only S-wave scattering. Triplet has to be zero, the triplet component is just the sum of these two, that's a polypencil effect, and that's a strict constraint then on the parameters. It's amazing, I only have the two parameters, A0S, A0A, and this triplet scattering, and I'm down to one, effectively one parameter. Remember, we had an infinite number of them to begin with in general, but because of the locality, it suddenly truncated it to two parameters, and then they're confined by this Pauli principle. As I approach the magnetic transition, as we pointed out before, this amplitude diverges, but in order to preserve this and the locality, this one would also have to diverge. So as we approach this transition, we would go through what would appear to be a density instability as well as a magnetic one. Whatever that is.
Your P less than PC, or P greater than PC, or something.
Yeah, and actually, I don't know what to do on the other side. I actually have a control theory on this side. On the other side, mm-hmm. We're all familiar with.
No.
It's totally uncontrolled on the other side. And we don't. And the thing is that on the ferromagnetic side, that T star is telling you that some of the physics was done for you, that there's got you to this low energy scale by this ferromagnetic transition, and now I have a control parameter. I don't have that control parameter under control in the same way as I have here. And again, there's a Migdal's theorem and all that other stuff working here. And that's the surprise. And just if I take that seriously, and this is, as I say, the other surprise was that PRL let us get away with that. We suggested already back in a year or so ago that, look, when I was younger, I would actually pretend like I could calculate these transition temperatures. I was more bold and willing to do it. Now I know better, but I can still wave my hands and come up with some estimate for the TC. So I took a guess at the MNSI. Now this would be, the singlet amplitude is attractive, so somewhere there must be some attractive pairing interaction. I don't know how to go from my scattering amplitudes in the Fermi-liquid plane, which is the particle-particle channel, but I know there's only S wave around, there's got to be a singlet pairing instability. I have an energy scale T star, which tells me that nothing's going to happen before T star. It's going, in fact, that's later on we found that if you tried to calculate it up here, you find it's very strongly suppressed. In this region, remember, we have these quasi-particles which are non-Fermi-liquid like. It means Z is zero, and it's very diffusive. It's very hard to have a pairing instability in that region, and you can demonstrate that it's quite suppressed. So we said, okay, this is a ferromagnet. S waves just don't like being in ferromagnets if the moments are too big. But there are various ways in which you can get an S wave. You can do it a la Larkin or Chinnikov for the ferro, which is a non-uniform phase, which is a finite momentum, total momentum phase. What we said, that in fact, this could in fact be a K equal to zero phase. It is total momentum zero, but if to do that, that means a quasi-particle in that paired state has to be off its Fermi surface.
which means that it's going to be strongly suppressed. Well, we said, okay, first thing first, I had to be inside the Fermi liquid regime, so I knew it had to be less than 1 Kelvin. And everything I could think of that would hurt TC, I just knocked off another order of magnitude. And after I did that a couple of times, I got down to 10 millikelvin. For MnSi at around 12 kilobar, which would be somewhere around where the peak is, and for zirconium zinc 2, it would be somewhere around 7 kilobar. They have roughly the same temperature scales as these stars and all that. This material has been around for a while, but the new superconducting phase found that if we plugged in the same sort of, you know, hand waving and brought it down by a few orders of magnitude, these stars is a bit larger. We got a number that's more like 0.3 Kelvin. And it's just because the Curie temperature is bigger by a factor of 5 multiplied by 25, T Fermi is roughly the same. Order of magnitude, it should be in this neighborhood, but just in the same argument. So initially, it was argued that it would, you know, have an onset, because it just didn't like being in this ferromagnetic background. It would reach a peak, and it's reaching this peak because that scattering amplitude is getting stronger as I approach the quantum critical point, and that thing is diverging. But at some point it says, well, I've got this energy scale here that's crashing to zero, so I'm going to have to get to zero. And so we suggested that the superconducting transition temperature should vanish at this quantum critical point. My graduate student at the time, now working with us, Krasnam Uglanov, referred to it as a naked quantum critical point, because all of the phases went to zero at that point, superconducting, magnetic, and so on.
Will this, yes, ferromagnetic movement, or is it new with
it? It actually lives with it. In fact, that's the main field that we've done recently, where, in fact, they can coexist. But where we've evaluated is, again, for small moments close to the quantum critical point. It gets pretty messy, because we solved just a couple mean field magnetic moment and superconducting water parameter. And it does coexist. Now, but to do that, let's see, this something happens. And it's just like if I put in a magnetic impurity into a superconductor, I generate gapless excitations. If you do it in the many-body system, you actually generate a whole Fermi surface of gapless excitations in order to accommodate the superconducting instability. Okay, so that was a year ago. Just recently in Nature, Gil Andrich's group discovered superconductivity in uranium-germanium-2, and this is the first one where this has been seen. This is multiplied by a factor of 10. The maximum is about 0.7, 0.75, somewhere around there, at this point here. And it has an onset, reaches the maximum. It may or may not be zero. It could be close to zero at that point. But no evidence for superconductivity out here. And the shape, couldn't ask for a better qualitative agreement with the theory. Of course, we were working with these guys, and they think of us as the alternative theory. You know, they have a nice P-wave. Their story is P-wave.
Yeah.
And I think it's wrong, but I think it's a good one. And let me just tell you.
We can shape an expert on it.
Well, there is an interesting, they haven't yet. But there is an interesting experiment, and I'll come back to it about band samples. But the prediction, we thought this would be an ironclad prediction, you know, good clean sample like this on linear specific heat at low temperature because I have gapless excitations. That was one of our big predictions. Well, there's a nice P wave, almost like the A1 phase in helium, where one of the spin species pairs first and then the other one is normal. And so that too would give you a large, you know, value. That also predicts a second phase transition. There's an A1, A2 phase transition that should occur. And so far, they haven't been able to resolve it, and it should be big enough. I think they've estimated, since Machida et al. Have estimated some 30 millikelvin separation between the two, but there's no clear evidence for it. So I think the many-body argument is one I like, since that was one we cooked up, that it would prefer S-wave, but the P-wave is not ruled out, except, and this is interesting, I just learned from Brian Maple, who was at this meeting in Los Alamos, he says they're very good at first making bad samples. That's their fame. And they measured the same
behavior. I see, they saw the peak in TC. Now, after the meeting, we suggested you go back and make even worse samples. And just try to get this, because the P wave would be much more sensitive to dirt. Also, this Larkin or Chinnikov folded ferrule phase would be more sensitive to it because it's an inhomogeneous phase and adding impurities will kind of mess that up. Whereas Ara, since it's K equal to zero and the quasi-particles are already far from the Fermi surface, they're already highly damped to begin with. And they may be less sensitive to presence of impurities.
Well, you could stabilize them in this inhomogeneous phase by dark.
Why not NMR? Isn't that light shift?
Well, the thing is, it would be, in both cases, you would have normal quasi-particles present. And I'm not sure. I think the presence of a second phase.
So you would also have a finite.
Because we have these gapless excitations. I mean, the interesting thing is that this actually creates a second, a new Fermi surface. And that's basically the price of trying to have the superconductivity of ferromagnetism present. Now, there was some work done on this in the 60s and 70s, but the magnetic moment was sort of used as an external parameter. They never really calculated in the coupled case. There was some numerical studies of it, and they didn't find the coexistence. But you can show, at least in a particular regime when the moment is small, that in fact there is a coexistence. And at least analytically. And so we're just doing the numerical phase diagram. I think Peter Littlewood and his student have kind of explored the whole phase diagram, but we haven't seen that yet during that process. So the bottom line is that there is something very interesting in these weak ferromagnets. There are some surprises.
Wasn't there some sort of a clapping mode in the T-wave superconductors that would be coupled with that?
Yeah, it depends on which one of the P-waves. A lot of those modes get suppressed because of spin orbit couplings and lattice couplings, and so they're gapped in the ways that they make it difficult to see them. The interesting one for this one, at least this A1 phase models, is that there should be a second phase condition, and it's a question of whether they're too close or not. And so that would be the alternative. And a lot of dirt might help distinguish. But again, the prejudice, and my own prejudice, would be that P-wave would be favored. But if I look at the many body arguments that I would use on the paramagnetic side, my prejudice have been changed now to the fact that many body physics suggests more strongly an S-wave. And so that's the end of the story. The surprises for me was that the S-wave could actually the potential pairing instability, and as you explore these ferromagnets more, you find that there are more collective modes in there than the standard textbook would suggest. So, thank you.
I don't remember what kind of P-wave they proposed.
It was like an A1 phase, so that one spin species paired first. I don't remember exactly all the details of it, but it's just like one of the species will pair first, and it's like an A1. Transition, and so there should be a second phase transition in the scheme. Because you know, you get this. Oh, the other thing is that the TC should depend on magnetic field. You should be able to get an enhancement of the. If you can put on a big enough magnetic field to make an effect there, you should actually see TC go up.
But one cannot directly observe the anisotropy in the spin susceptibility because it's already lost by this paramagnetic metal, right?
The one thing. And I think it also comes from Mars as well, since only one of the, you know, the spin species in the A1 phase is paired, then the specific heat jump will be in this range of about 0.7 or so, about half of what it is in the weak coupling CS case. But again, for us, you know, we have those normal quasi-particles around as well, so we'll probably have a reduced specific heat jump as well. We haven't calculated it yet. We're in the process of doing all that right now. And we're exploring then all these things like the T1s and
Is your Fermi surface small, or
you get No, it's actually still pretty large. It's close to, well, for the small moment anyway, but, you know, you can show it's close to the original one. The original one, of course, is split. Right, it's spin split. Before it goes superconducting, it's spin split already because of the internal field. And then there's an additional new Fermi surface on top of that that comes out. And one of the excitations has a gap in it, so it's kind of pushed away, and the other excitations are gaps.
It seems to me there's another class of improvements you can do to stoner theory, which were addressed by Maria and Hubbard and Kim Bode coupling. There are other theories that in the vicinity of TC, which itself is going to zero, you have to worry about short-range water effects coming in.
On the permit or the Frohman?
Well, that was the argument was coming down from below. The experiments began to show that you were seeing short-range water, and that was partly responsible for something like a Curie blob, which you never expected from the swimming pool. So in addition to all this Fermi liquid-like machinery that was used, I presume there's another machinery out there, and I'm not even sure it's entirely compatible, but the mode comp, I guess I
didn't worry
about these Maria. Well, there's more in there than just
But it actually, you know, the mode coupling is, again, it's another level of an attempt to do more microscopic things. The Fermi-liquid theory says, I don't care where the parameters came from.
Right.
Came from some very complicated calculation that gave me this. You should also remember that nobody's done a calculation yet to show that anything like a Hubbard model for ferromagnetic metal has ferromagnetic instability. There is no calculation without doing something special, like pretending the Fermi surface has some weird structures in it, never recalculating the Fermi surface when these calculations are done. But if you just try to do something like a Hubbard model, there is no ferromagnetic instability away from
the... Yeah,
but the Stoner criteria is... If you try to do a real calculation, Stoner is... That's Hartree-Fock.
Yeah, no, this is some version of Hartree-Fock.
No, because Hartree-Fock means it's really related in first order perturbation theory to the real potential.
Yeah.
I don't know where my Fermi-liquid parameters came from. I'm just telling you, I have a ferromagnet, and because I have a ferromagnet, I can tell you what the Fermi-liquid parameters must be in the sense that they've got F node A has to be less than minus one. And once I...
Are these then really combined viewpoints that the Fermi-liquid theory really accounts for all the microscopics of the...
All the low energy, low temperature...
That presumably is all incorporated through the Fermi-liquid.
Because Maria tried to do something a bit more microscopic.
She
tried to calculate...
But it would just be more Landau parameters?
It should be...
The dynamics became different, the whole neutron...
But again, for low energy, low temperature, small wavelength, if it's not doing what these Fermi-liquids are doing, then something wrong with these dynamics. Because these things are Fermi-liquids at low temperature. And just like in helium, who's ever calculated for real the effective mass starting from the disease potential for helium-3? Nobody. Right? There's the connection between the real Hamiltonian and the Fermi-liquid parameters in helium-3 hasn't been established yet. We all know this is still one of the best examples of Fermi-liquid. And I can give you the parameters, and I can measure some of them in various experiments, like effective mass and so on. But we've never calculated. We can't even calculate the ground state energy. We can do it for helium-4, but the sign problem gets you when you try to do helium-3.
But in helium-3, I got this question, which was asked by you when you first had a dialogue version of Oslo, and you first had a permanent version.
Somebody brought up this question. There is some features in this phase diagram. Somewhere around here, I believe it's got first order, weak first order transition, maybe even strong, right around here. It's second order up there somewhere, but then, and just like in MNSI, there's a weak first order that you can kill with a magnetic field, but there's usually weak first order in that. And I think it's because it's a pretty bizarre region. If you look at all of these correlation functions, they're all going unstable in that neighborhood. But just in the simple calculation we did here, you can see the charge correlations have to become very long-range, and if you start to throw in Coulomb interactions, you can have all sorts of funny instabilities going on there. And so this is, in my view, probably the most dramatic quantum critical point you can imagine. Everything is going to zero at that point. There's all of the transition temperatures are going to be zero at that point. But there are a lot of correlation lines that are diverging as well.
Could you say a little more about that star going to zero? I completely missed it. The star is 1/1 + 1 or something.
No, it's not. It's just, it's only related for...
Fermi-liquid fixed point, that is.
But that's for Galilean-Baron. If I have a local self-energy in a non-Galilean-Baron system, you can relate it back to derivatives of the self-energy. And in fact, it's strictly, in a strictly local theory, the effective mass and the quasi-particle weight are reciprocals of one another. So as you approach the quantum critical point, the quasi-particle strength, which is z, goes to zero, and the mass diverges. And it diverges logarithmically in the magnetization.
So wait, but this transition z does not go to zero.
At this point, Z goes to zero.
No, so in an advanced ferromagnet, you still have quasi particles. Is that true or not?
At that point, you don't have Fermi liquid like positive, you can see experimentally, you have all non-Fermi liquid like exponents to specific heats and resistivities. So at the quantum critical point, you don't have quasi-particles in the, you don't have fermionic quasi-particles like in the Fermi liquid type. Because if you did, you'd have a nice linear specific heat, just the way of resistivity. And it extends over pretty, as I was saying before, it extends over pretty high temperature range, and I'm not sure on this one here, I think it pretty quickly into a Fermi liquid regime on this side for uranium, germanium 2, but I think it was MNSI. I forget what the pressure they went up to, but very high pressures, far from the critical point. It still hadn't yet settled into a normal Fermi liquid behavior.
What about deep inside the Fermi liquid phase?
Then it's well-defined Fermi liquid behavior. That's the experimental statement. The experimental statement is below this scale T star. These are well-defined Fermi liquids in the ferromagnetic regime. And then everything else that followed from that was that this is a Fermi liquid and the thermodynamics and the dynamics follows just from the same kind of scheme that Landau invented in 50 some odd years ago.
The silver gets small and higher, what looks like an
idea? It's basically, you can show that the magnons in this case are just like acoustic phonons, and that there is really Migdal's theorem, and that all of the corrections that would give rise to momentum dependence really are of order TC over EF. I mean, it's a calculation that was in that PRL as well. But we had an earlier paper which PRL didn't accept because we didn't have a microscopic justification for the assumption that it was local. But later on, we just showed that the magnons actually behave in many ways like acoustic phonons. So it becomes local with corrections which are really of the order of TC over EF. And it's just something you can show.
It assumes that the magnon level.
Well, it's the magnon exchange which is giving rise to the self-energy in that sense, yes.
Not near the critical. Well, I mean, the critical point is the critical fluctuation.
Yeah, right at the critical point. I mean, I can always, be a little bit away. And the thing is, how wide is that region? I don't think we know how wide the quantum critical region is. At least theoretically, I wouldn't have an approach it. Experimentally, it seems to be pretty broad. So, thank you again for listening.
Good, thanks.